Hello, and thank you for listening to Mapping the Zone, a podcast dedicated to informal discussion of the works and context of Thomas Pynchon. My name is Kate.
My name is Cody.
I'm Luke.
And I'm Will.
No way. our podcast has so far been dedicated to Against the Day for the current season that we're doing, but because of the sort of mammoth task that that book represents, what we've decided to do is sort of break it up into individual chunks, where in between those chunks of what we're actually like covering, we're going to be going through Thomas Pynchon's short stories. Because there's not, you know, unlike a lot of his novels, there's not as much to discuss with those. You know, if you do want to get into like real deep analysis, there's a couple that you can certainly do that with, particularly his later short stories that he was writing. But his early ones, there's not a ton of the same content to break down. You know, for example, there's not even like Pynchon wiki entries for the slow learner stories. So we were trying to discuss, you know, so sort of what would be the appropriate way to kind of include this in our schedule, so to speak, of covering his entire bibliography. And the best thing that we came up with was slotting them in between these sections of Against the Day, because as Cody, our resident schedule master, figured out, the chunks that are the book was broken up into mapped one-to-one to how many stories are in this collection. And so that was what we decided to do. I guess, sort of at the top, before we get into even the introduction, have we all read his short stories before? Is this the first time for anybody? Like, what is your individual experience with his short stories?
I've read them. I think the only one I haven't read is the Mortality and Mercy in Vienna. Mm-hmm. I think that's the only one I haven't. I don't know if I'm getting the title right, but I think that's the only one I haven't read of his. But it's been a while since I've read them. I think the last time I picked up Slow Learner was like 2 or 3 years ago, maybe. I remember not particularly being terribly impressed with any of them, with the exception of Secret Integration. I really liked that one. And I'm probably going to be the same going through this again, but you know, it's his early work, and he's critical of it as well. And it's, you know, it's an interesting insight into his progress as a writer. So I think mm-hmm. it's kind of to be expected that it's not going to be on par with, you know, his later works and his more masterful creations.
The title is certainly apt.
Mm-hmm.
Similar to you, I've read all of his short stories. I had an ebook edition of Slow Learner for a really long time, and then eventually I found an actual first edition paperback of it in a Half Price Books near me. It has like a weirdly large amount of Pynchon stuff there. And picked it up, so that's what I'm the edition I'm going to be reading out of for the purpose of discussion. I enjoy them. I think that obviously, like, you know, the ones that stand out the most are the ones that stand out the most for everybody, and that's like Entropy and, you know, The Secret Integration, those stories that, mm-hmm. that are closest to what would become kind of the quintessential Pynchon. But you know, they're it's interesting to see him writing not just in a smaller format, but also one that you know, lacks stakes, for example.
Yeah.
Like what he writes when he doesn't have this big kind of map, right, or an idea in his head. And I think that, you know, it is very interesting to watch a writer develop their own talent over the course of, you know, like one collection of short stories. I wish that something like this existed for more authors, where it was a bunch of their early writing mixed with, you know, an introduction that effectively provides a carry for all of them.
Yeah.
Luke, Will, what about you guys?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a completionist in a lot of ways, with a few different authors. So I had read Slow Learner a few years ago, more than a few, probably about 10 years ago, as I was working my way through Pynchon. I don't remember exactly when in the sequence of reading Pynchon's books when I read it. I remember thinking, you know, I don't think they're as bad as Pynchon kind of makes them out. The short stories, I don't think the short stories are as bad as Pynchon makes them out to be in the introduction. You know, if somebody had just kind of handed me this short story collection and told me that this guy would go on to write masterpieces like Gravity's Rainbow, Against the Day, Mason and Dixon, etc., I would have been maybe not super surprised, but kind of surprised at the very least that he develops into the writer that he eventually developed into. Like, kind of like there's not a lot of manic energy in the short stories, and like I've been thinking lately about how, especially Gravity's Rainbow, but just kind of in general, how his writing can kind of have that. Manic is one word for it. It's maybe not the best word for it. It's just he seems to be like, you know, he's always kind of blazing his own trail. And with these short stories, they don't seem as original as what was to come.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fair.
Yeah. I'm the odd one out then. I have prior to embarking on this episode, I had read the introduction, and I had read is it Under the Rose that was in V? So that is my total exposure to the book or to the stories of Slow Learner.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah. I realized after reading the introduction and thinking about how much I struggled to enjoy V that it was going to mostly be valuable as an exercise of just understanding him as an author more than mm-hmm. anything that I'd enjoy. And The Small Rain has not disabused me of that notion. But I did have a really good time getting into kind of the way that you could see the themes that he would later zone in on and mm-hmm. build into actually meaningful concepts and meaningful characters and plots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed. Oh, and I like the way that you phrase that too, from a perspective of, you know, as an exercise in getting to know him as an author and as his development, because I have a feeling that that's why this exists in the first place. Like, you know, I think Pynchon is probably aware of the mystique surrounding him, given that he has more or less deliberately cultivated it. And I think that, you know, it makes sense that he may want to put something else out like this, where it's fairly low stakes in regards to what it is that he's providing a commentary on, but does sort of reveal his development process of, you know, and I think that it's fairly considered in its packaging and how it's been released, especially in the way that something like this is not really commonly done with other writers, at least not to my knowledge.
Yeah. That's kind of the thing. It's like, even I think it's a pretty bold move on his part to release these stories just because of the sort of that they were created with, because when you go from these stories to like Lot 49 and Gravity's Rainbow, and like the time frame between them, it's not a tremendous amount of time, but it's a tremendous amount of growth. And for an author to be willing to say, here's what I was doing that I can look back on and honestly say was maybe not very good, but this is where I started. Yeah, you don't get a lot of authors that do that. We get a lot of authors that release a bunch of short story collections, and they're usually, you know, really good or they're okay. But it's rare to get an author that is willing to give such an unflinching view of their earliest work and to put it out there for judgment, essentially.
Mm-hmm. So kind of speaking of that, there's a pretty lengthy introduction to Slow Learner written by the man himself. Mine runs 22 pages in the edition that I'm reading from. This is a sort of one of those pieces of writing of Pynchon's that gets discussed a fair amount. I remember when I was first getting into Pynchon, mostly through the Reddit group that this podcast actually was founded off of the back of, there was, you know, it was one of those things that got referred to pretty regularly. As far as, well, you know, in the introduction to Slow Learner, he mentions this, or like in the introduction to Slow Learner, he mentions this, or, you know. And so it is, and I think that the importance of that, as I've stated a couple of times, is the fact that it is sort of the closest thing that we have to the man himself commenting on his work. And there's some pretty interesting comments in there about his understanding or lack thereof of entropy, which would become a defining theme in his work. Pretty much for the entirety of his body of work.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting sort of disagreement he maybe has with his audience from a perspective of his own understanding of something like that. And just sort of, you know, to Will's point, an articulation of some of the themes that he was developing that would later become a pretty big deal to his writing as a whole. So from there, I just sort of want to open it up to you guys. What are your thoughts on the introduction? Do you have anything specific you want to bring up? We will be reading the section in the introduction that relates specifically to each story as we go, but obviously there's a lot of, you know, connective tissue there as far as just sort of general comments on his own career and his own development, and a lot of comments on his influences too, which is neat. Influences that existed at certain times of his life that you know affected what he was thinking about or what he was writing. What do we think about the intro to Slow Learner?
I really enjoyed reading it. It really, you know, like I said earlier, it really gives an insight into an author who, in all honesty, will probably, you know, leave a legacy of being one of the greatest authors of all time.
Yeah.
And the sort of nakedness that he approaches it with, of, you know, understanding that this was the work of a younger man who didn't fully have a grasp on what his voice was, what his style was. There was a lot of, you know, as you mentioned, there was a lot of influence that was very, very clearly shown, rather than just sort of being overt and kind of, you know, blanketed and covered in there a little bit, but not being super in your face. I had to push back where he talked about his view on science fiction and fantasy, that I suspect one of the reasons that fantasy and science fiction appeal so much to younger readers is that when the space and time have been altered to allow characters to travel easily anywhere through the continuum and thus escape physical dangers and timepiece inevitabilities, mortality is so seldom an issue. Granted, that's probably a product of this being from 85, I think. Fantasy and sci-fi, I think, have come a long way since then, and that's not really such an issue anymore. I think there's plenty of fantasy and sci-fi out there that...
Hard sci-fi.
Yeah. There's definitely a lot of higher stakes sci-fi and fantasy out there now. So, but I do also, you know, the fact that he mentions in my edition, this is on page 11, where he's talking about, I believe it's when he's talking about the slow rain, maybe the lowlands. But he says modern readers will be at least put off by an unacceptable level of racist, sexist, and proto-fascist talk throughout the story. I wish I could say that this is only Pig Bodine's voice, but sad to say, it was also my own at the time. Best I can say for it now is that for its time, it is probably authentic enough. So, you know, again, this is someone who's willing to confront their younger self and their views at that time, and to say, yeah, this is where I was then, but I've clearly grown as a person. I've clearly grown as a writer. I look back at that and I cringe at what I was saying, because it wasn't just the character saying it, that was also me coming through. So it's a very bold and brave thing to do as an author, to really put yourself out there that much and to be willing to so openly discuss your own flaws and then present what it is you're critiquing. And so I have to give a lot of props for that, because it's really not seldom, it's not done very often, you know?
That's true. I also, just to kind of extend the section you read about, which it is in reference to the lowlands, but I appreciate what he says next too, where he says, John Kennedy's role model James Bond was about to make his name by kicking third world people around, another extension of the boys' adventure tales a lot of us grew up reading. There prevailed for a while a set of assumptions and distinctions, unvoiced and unquestioned, best captured years later by the 70s television character Archie Bunker. It's a very simple thing that he mentions there, the fact that James Bond is running around shooting and infiltrating third world countries, but it that is exactly what that franchise is. and it's an example of how propaganda can come in weird forms, and how that is a logical endpoint or extension of boys' adventure novels, which is obviously very relevant to what we keep talking about with the Chums of Chance, and how they seem to constantly be at the whims of something shadowy and sort of the elements of power that are working towards a nefarious end. So it isn't just the fact that he can acknowledge the fact that, you know, his younger self maybe had some problematic point of views on the world, but also that he understands why he ended up that way and how entertainment and the publishing industry and culture can push people towards that. It's very, very relevant to not just when he was writing it then, but also stuff going on in the world now.
Yeah,
I like the intro a lot. I especially like the insight into Navy life in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. Found that really interesting. Also about Elvis Presley and stuff was pretty funny. That being said, it does, you know, as a writer myself, you know, all of these stories are actually published. Finchin isn't necessarily super clear about. I know that he wrote some stories for his high school newspaper that I think you can find in some type of like scholarly collection of Finchin's writings. I think you can still find those short stories. He's not like necessarily super clear that if he had written other stories and if he tried to submit them or if they weren't published and stuff like that. And I say all of that just because, you know, it's not super easy to write a story that's publishable, especially when you're 20, 21, 22. Which I guess Finchin might have been a little bit older than that because he spent 2 years in the Navy in the middle of his college years. So maybe he was 23 or 24. I agree that maybe his short stories aren't as good as what would come later. But, on their own, none of them are necessarily bad, in my opinion, especially for the time that they were published. It doesn't annoy me. Annoy is not the right word, but it's just kind of, I wish he was more positive about the stories and stuff, just because, you know, it's not easy to publish at that age or to publish really at any age. I love the stuff about Kerouac, especially, and the whole beat, straight people or like square dichotomy of the late 1950s has always interested me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of cool references in the introduction and stuff. Cool quotes, and I like that he kind of goes through each story and gives credit where credit is due about the inspirations and stuff, and gives you. I really enjoyed all the stuff about the meaning of the word entropy, and yeah, just all the stuff about the Beat Generation and college life in the 1950s.
It is interesting that he comments so heavily on the Beat Generation as something that influenced like his perspective or his outlook at the time, because it's not really reflected very much in what he's writing at the time, at least not to my sensibility. I mean, I'm sure it's maybe difficult to get away from that in general from a perspective of like being in academia at the time, but it is interesting that like some of that stuff must play into why he chose to write the way that he did, but didn't necessarily play out the way that you would expect on the page. At least not at this point. And I agree with you, you know, being published is not an easy thing. Maybe it was easier back then just simply because there was less people writing. But
yeah,
Pynchon's sort of self-deprecation in regards to both his short stories and, you know, The Crying of Lot 49 in particular has always been one of those things that has both simultaneously confused me and also made me feel a sense of kinship with him as also a published writer. To a certain extent, every writer thinks that their older work sucks and is not really worthy of being looked at. And the idea that someone at his level of stature has the same feeling about his own work makes me feel pretty good about myself.
I think that if there's like a singular thrust to get from, that I get at least from the introduction, it might not be self-conscious. It feels self-consciously so, but it's very much kind of a repudiation of the interpretation of the insistence that a lot of critics, especially non-professional criticism of Finchin's, that boils down to, well, he uses obscurantism as his primary method to trick people into thinking that he is a good author, or that he is using these diffuse references as a way to distract people. It really, what I think this introduction does is it establishes that he, at least past books like V and Lot 49, he was genuinely writing with the same kind of intentions as most authors tend to. He's trying to write stories that he thinks gets at something human. He's trying to write characters that he believes in and can root for. Of course, taste is taste, but not gonna decry anyone who doesn't feel that his characters are real or worth caring about. It isn't some pure exercise. He. A lot of this introduction is him basically saying, "You can't write anything in the world of prose fiction from the standpoint of theme first. You can't write something."
Right.
Is trying to be self-consciously literary. You just have to write something that you believe in and try to make it better. And that's it's interesting because I think it rewards a lot of the earnest appreciation that goes on in the Pynchon community online, where there's a handful of people who are very proud of themselves for reading these very hard books. And the fact is that that's not most of the people who read his books. That's not Pynchon himself, or at least it wasn't once he got his legs under him as an author. And that's an interesting dichotomy, because the public perception of Pynchon is as an author who wrote to be difficult, an author who the only people who enjoy his work are people who want to look intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
Just it's an interesting, very clear statement to the contrary. As much as I agree, Luke, these aren't, like, at least The Small Rain is not a bad story. It's fine. I didn't love it, but that's because I had some part of me hoped that it would be as good as his later works.
Mm-hmm.
And it just didn't strike a chord for me. But it's not bad. It's good. It's a good little story.
And it's very simple.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The whole of the introduction being him saying, look, here are all of the flaws in my early work. Here are all of these lessons I had to learn slowly and painfully, and most writers will too. So get off my back about, he took so much LSD that he doesn't even remember what he wrote. And maybe that's true, but that's not the point. I'm pretty sure most authors who write 500 plus page novels don't remember everything they wrote.
I think that's a trap that a lot of artists in general tend to get stuck in, is the fan base tends to remember or have more, take more away from the work than maybe was intended. And then they can turn on the creator, in a sense, when they don't really, when their, you know, remembrance of it or their take on it doesn't line up with the fan's take on it, which is, it's an unfortunate thing to see happen, but it does happen. And it's as frustrating as the people who do the, you know, that read these kind of books for clout and just don't really, they're not really taking anything away from it other than, hey, look at this big, thick book I read and it's super challenging. So give me, you know, pat me on the back.
Give me internet points.
There's one particular paragraph that I think belies a lot more of, it has now been too long and far too much of me rambling for me to remember exactly what it was you'd said, Kate, that made me think of this. But there was there's this line talking about how he uses language. At the simplest level, it had to do with language. We were encouraged from many directions, Kerouac and the beat writers, the diction of Saul Bellow and the Adventures of Og, voices like those of Herbert Gulliproth, to see how at least two very distinct kinds of English could be allowed in fiction to coexist. Allowed! It was actually okay to write like this! Who knew? And it's the kind of stuff that I think is a hallmark of, in it within Pynchon's oeuvre, is, you know, it's a hallmark of Crying of Lot 49, of Gravity's Rainbow, of Small Parts of Against the Day, and then Bleeding Edge, the very self-conscious use of punctuation marks to actually mean something within the text and not just to be divisions between what could be assumed.
Right.
And I think that it's that kind of use of language that really shows the beat influences in Pynchon's early works.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I like what you had said about the introduction essentially being a repudiation of the idea that you can write theme first and then character second. Because as we'll get to when we read the section for Small Rain, you know, he articulates something about Small Rain that is not necessarily directly on the page as far as what he was trying to do. From this idea of, like, the characters in Small Rain are all trying to deal with death in very juvenile ways, right? Which is, like, oh, okay, yeah, sure, probably. But I can't say that you can, like, get through the very short runtime, so to speak, of Small Rain and come away feeling like there is a complete synthesis of that thematic idea. Mm-hmm. But what there are... what is certainly present in spades in Small Rain is characters who do, to a certain extent in the space that he allows for them, feel like they are probably based on real people in the army that Pynchon came across at one point or another. So, you know, as far as, like, a very real concrete idea of that, it is very present just from the very first story, what you're talking about. So yeah, that's a great sort of synthesis of everything that he's kind of getting at with that introduction.
I did want to push back a little bit on something that Kate and Will said, and Pynchon himself says, on the whole, like, where you start with a story and you can't start with themes or an idea, because I do think that that's a rule I have. I think, generally speaking, with writing, you should start with characters and character motivations and flesh out the characters first. That being said, you know, I'm a big fan of Italo Calvino, and that whole short story series is, he starts with like a scientific fact or something of the time. A lot of the scientific facts are kind of outdated, and he builds a whole short story out of them. So I do think you can do that successfully, but it has to be, you have to be a very good writer. And I don't think that Pynchon is probably at that level, at the time of writing Slow Learner.
Yeah, I mean, so I just to put it out there, you know, both of y'all are published authors. You guys know far more than I do. What I would say is the sense I get from reading a few other books on like the actual the art of writing, reading as much as I have, which is not a ton, but not a little. I do get the sense that if you come up with those themes, if you come up with ideas, and you come up with characters who in that parallel way truly do fit that, or you meet someone who seems to embody those kinds of ideas, it does seem like most authors can use their character part of their brains, their intuitive empathy part of their brains, to get at those same themes. It does seem like every instance of an author who is insistent upon trying to only write from a thematic standpoint does not find success, I guess, if that makes sense. Not necessarily as popularly, but, you know, as an artist, they do seem to write themselves into points where they get frustrated with themselves. And I'm thinking specifically of, like, the way Jonathan Franzen talks about his early books.
Yeah. That was what I was thinking of too, as you were describing that.
Does that make sense to either of y'all, I guess, is yeah. Why I'm saying that.
It does, yeah.
Yeah. I agree that, like, to a certain extent, if you're trying to write from a thematic first perspective, you can do that, but it does, like you're saying, Will, kind of require you to find or shape an anchor to it. And if you lean too heavily in the direction of writing specifically from a thematic perspective, you end up losing something for your audience to actually attach to.
Because, yeah, I mean, it's hard to really say that books like Gravity's Rainbow or Against the Day, or even Mason and Dixon, which is often called Pynchon's most character-driven work, you cannot honestly say that every choice in those books isn't predicated on thematic logic, even if it
right.
isn't the driving yeah. force of the actual sentences.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's just, yeah, all of those things need to be anchored, and people don't anchor themselves to ideas as easily as they do to people.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to write everything in a Hegelian form, I'll read your work. Don't know how many other people will.
You'll get at least one sale, but it'll have to be marketed that way as well.
Yeah.
Starting on page 4 of the introduction in my edition, says, "The Small Rain is my first published story. A friend who'd been away in the Army the same 2 years I'd been in the Navy supplied the details. The hurricane really happened, and my friend's Signal Corps detachment had the mission described in the story. Most of what I dislike about my writing is present here in embryo, as well as in more advanced form. I failed to recognize, just for openers, that the main character's problem was real and interesting enough to generate a story on its own. Apparently, I felt I had to put on a whole extra overlay of rain images and references to The Wasteland and A Farewell to Arms. I was operating on the motto, make it literary, a piece of bad advice I made up all by myself and then took. Equally embarrassing is the case of bad ear to be found, marring much of the dialogue, especially towards the end. My sense of regional accents in these days was primitive at best. I had noticed how in the military voices got homogenized into one basic American country voice. Italian street kids from New York started to sound like down-home folks after a while. Sailors from Georgia came back off leave, complaining that nobody could understand them because they talked like Yankees. Being from the North, what I was hearing as a Southern accent was really this uniform service accent and not much else. I imagined I'd heard ooh for "ow" in civilian voices around Tidewater, Virginia, but didn't know that in different areas of this real or civilian South, even in different parts of Virginia, people spoke in a wide number of quite different accents. It is an error also noticeable in movies of the time. My specific problem is the barroom scene in not only that I have a Louisiana girl talking in Tidewater diphthongs, imperfectly her to begin with, but worse, that I insist on making it an element of plot. It makes a difference to Levine, and therefore to what happens in the story. My mistake being to try to show off my ear before I had one. At the heart of the story, most crucial and worrisome, is the defective way in which my narrator, almost but not quite me, deals with the subject of death. When we speak of seriousness in fiction, ultimately we are talking about an attitude toward death, how characters may act in its presence, for example, or how they handle it when it isn't so immediate. Everybody knows this. But the subject is hardly ever brought up with younger writers, possibly because given to anyone at the apprentice age, such advice is widely felt to be effort wasted. I suspect one of the reasons that fantasy and science fiction appeal to much younger readers is that when space and time have been altered to allow characters to travel easily anywhere through the continuum and thus escape physical dangers and timepiece inevitabilities, mortality is so seldom an issue. In The Small Rain, characters are found dealing with death in pre-adult ways. They evade. They sleep late. They seek euphemism. When they do mention death, they try to make with the jokes. Worst of all, they hook it up with sex. You'll notice that toward the end of the story, some kind of sexual encounter appears to take place. Though, you'll never know it from the text. The language suddenly gets too fancy to read. Maybe this wasn't my own adolescent nervousness about sex. I think, looking back, that there might have been a general nervousness in the whole college-age subculture, a tendency to self-censorship. It was also the era of Howl, Lolita, Tropic of Cancer, and all the excesses of law enforcement that such works provoked. Even the American softcore pornography available in those days went to absurdly symbolic lengths to avoid describing sex. Today, this all seems a dead issue, but back then it felt constraint on the folks writing. What I find interesting about the story now is not so much the quaintness and puerility of attitude as the class angle. Whatever else the peacetime service is good for, it can provide an excellent introduction to the structure of society at large. It becomes evident even to a young mind that often unacknowledged divisions in civilian life find clear and immediate expression in the military distinction between officers and men. One makes the amazing discovery that grown adults walking around with college educations wearing khaki and brass and charged with heavy-duty responsibilities can, in fact, be idiots. And that working-class white hats, while in theory capable of idiocy, are much more apt to display competence, courage, humanity, wisdom, and other virtues associated by the educated classes with themselves. Although cast in literary terms, lard-ass Levine's conflict in this story is about where to put his loyalties. Being an unpolitical 50s student, I was unaware of this at the time, but in hindsight, I think I was working out a dilemma that most of us writing then had in some way to deal with. At the simplest level, it had to do with language. We were encouraged from many directions. Kerouac and the Beat Writers, the diction of Saul Bellow, the adventures of Augie March, emerging voices like those of Herbert Gold and Philip Roth, see how at least two very distinct kinds of English could be allowed in fiction to coexist. Allowed! It was actually okay to write like this! Who knew? The effect was exciting, liberating, strongly positive. It was not a case of either or, but an expansion of possibilities. I don't think we were consciously groping after any synthesis, although perhaps we should have been. The success of the New Left later in the 60s was to be limited by the failure of college kids and blue-collar workers to get together politically. One reason was the presence of real, invisible class force fields in the way of communication between the two groups. And that brings us to the story itself. Luke, you have an overview prepared for that, or a summary?
We open with the weather. It is hot and humid around an army base located in Louisiana. It is the year 1957, and the soldiers are feeling lazy. The soldiers are feeling lethargic. Nathan, lard-ass Levine, the hero of our story, is reading a paperback while lying in bed. The lardass is from the Bronx, he's apparently gone native and grown a wretched beer belly. Dugan, a conspiracy-minded racist, arrives to tell lardass that their lieutenant wants to see him. Lardass gets off his ass and walks to see his CO. Once there, he finds out his scheduled leave has been suspended. He's going to Lake Charles, where a hurricane has recently hit the coast. Lord S and his compatriots get on the road following lunch, heading southwest of Fort Roach. Lord S reads a book called Swamp Wench as they make their journey. Once they arrive, they, of course, head for a bar with the company intellectual, Rizzo. The group finds a newspaper and gets filled in on the reason for their mission. A hurricane has hit a small coastal town called Creole, and 250 people are missing. The Weather Bureau apparently miscalculated the timing of the hurricane's arrival, and the town had been hit by the storm by surprise. They leave the bar to rendezvous with their LT. While they wait, they meet a shell-shocked captain who just came back from what remains of Creole. The army has taken over the campus of McNeese State College, so they head there and set up communication equipment, then go to the bar for a nightcap. Once at the bar, Lord S is compared to a seed that is unable to grow, a play on one of Jesus's parables and the first of two biblical references in the story. The next day, they are woken by the taking off and landing of helicopters. Lord S chats with a fellow soldier about the situation in Creole. The whole town is submerged, and there are almost too many bodies for the government to handle. Lord S acquires coffee and sandwiches from a co-ed who he flirts with, then heads for Creole, where he observes the processing of the many, many dead bodies. They head back to Lake Charles, and Lord S showers and shaves in preparation for going to a bar. Next, Lord S heads out to indulge in Friday night shenanigans. He meets up with the girl from earlier in the day, whose date got too drunk and supposedly left, except the date shows back up and knocks over someone's beer. There's a small scuffle, and the soldiers leave and head home. The following day, Lord S heads back to where they are still processing dead bodies and does more observing. Then he hitches a ride to Creole proper and helps recover more dead bodies. And then he arrives back at the occupied campus and cleans up. Next, he walks to a bar, thinking about his newfound sense of restlessness and compares himself to the biblical wandering Jew. He meets up with his date and they drink for a while, then head out for a cabin located deep in the swamps where these two young people get together and Lord S waxes poetic for a while. The next day, Lord S gets his leave and leaves for Roach, falling asleep on the way.
All right. So what did we think of This Small Rain?
It's fine. That's really all I can say about it. Like, I felt like it got more interesting at the end, and the beginning and middle felt a little bit just kind of meandering.
Mm-hmm.
There were some parts in it that I enjoyed, but overall, I was just, you know, I came away from it like, okay, well, what's next?
Right. We've said it a couple of times in illusory ways before we got into the sort of story proper. There's not nearly as much to kind of sink your teeth in from a thematic perspective or a breakdown perspective. It is still, you know, remarkably well written from an actual, yeah, like, you know, syntax and grammar and you know, sentence structure way. Like, it's very clear that he, to some degree, had some preternatural writing talent, given how early this was sort of in his development of his own skills. And it is genuinely surprising how quickly he would go from that to, you know, V, right?
Yeah.
That is an absolutely astonishing sort of development time as a writer. There are still, you know, some characteristic pinch-on stuff. There's funny names in there. There's individual jokes that are entertaining. The idea that he shows up late to the meeting, and so he doesn't know what the actual mission that the detail he's about to go out on is, and no one will tell him until he actually arrives. You know, that is certainly reminiscent of sort of later absurdity that he'll include in different things. But yeah, you know, there's not a lot to break down. It is perfectly fine.
Yeah, I mean, I would go so far as to say it's good. I wouldn't say it's great. It is weirdly restrained, especially compared to his later stuff. It's maybe tries too hard to be literary, as he points out in the introduction.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I didn't feel like the literary allusions were like worked in too much. It's just I just felt like they were kind of unnecessary. I thought the biblical allusions were a lot better done than the literary allusions. I do think that that this story would still get published today if you were to submit it some places. I don't think it would get published in like the New Yorker or like, you know, any major venue for short stories, but I do think you could find a home for it today. I do kind of wish that the action, you know, him discovering all the dead bodies and the kind of disgusting nature of that were explored more, was more in depth. there's a little bit too much of like bantering between Lardass and his fellow soldiers, where it's kind of a little bit repetitive. The whole story is a little bit repetitive at times, not like super repetitive, but it does kind of repeat itself and kind of go through the same sequence of events a few times.
As far as my appraisal goes, it feels really weird. It feels, to make a baking analogy, it feels undermixed. It feels like he has these ideas. He has this idea of what the plot is supposed to be, and he has these ideas of what kind of thematic vibes he wants to go for. And it feels like there's something he's trying to get at, but none of it, as far as I could tell, it's not as though fiction should be hiding a message, but it's so clearly intentionally like overly dense in portions, and then also in those moments of dialogue there's clear unnecessary exposition about what's happening, or like, you know, how you're supposed to read the characters' interpretations of those things, which as an author he pretty swiftly got rid of, at least with his novels. And so it feels like it doesn't quite come together, I guess, is what I would say. Because the plot, I get it, I get what happens, I understand what the characters are doing and how they feel about each other, but I don't know why I am supposed to be reading this story, right? Why does this exist?
Yeah. it definitely really feels like early work. It feels like a writer who wants to take chances but is afraid to. And so there's these kind of moments of almost dipping his toes into the water of trying to do something really interesting and different, but then an immediate backup of just like, no, I don't want to, I can't do that right now. Let's just do it safe and tell the story in that kind of way. So it read to me just like somebody just telling an old army story. There wasn't really much else to it. There wasn't really any, it felt low stakes and just kind of, I think undermixed is a good metaphor for it. I think that's probably the best way to look at it.
Well, it is interesting to go from what he says the story is ostensibly about in his introduction to actually reading it. You know, like I had like made an allusion to earlier, that stuff is not really on the page, but he, you know, at that age, right, thinks that it's there. And I remember doing that same thing where I thought that I was, you know, that the stuff I was writing had this particularly like really smart, like literary element to it or thematic element to it. And then when other people would read it, I'd be like, did you get it? And then they all would have no fucking idea what I was talking about. It is an interesting illustration in that concept as a result of its undermixing and how there is a significant difference in perspective from the person writing something to the person reading something. Especially as it comes to what everything means or what everything is included in there. It is a very good exercise in understanding that particular dichotomy.
I do think it's interesting that the soldiers in the like that are depicted, they're part of like, you know, like they're setting up the whole point of their mission ostensibly, I think, is to set up communication equipment that went down. And I do wonder if that part of the story kind of played into that's obviously, you know, this is set in the 1950s, but that would have been a type of kind of a precursor to the internet in some ways. And it also kind of plays into his later work with Boeing on the Bomark project. And I do kind of wonder if one of the reasons he was put on the Bomark project is because of this short story.
Yeah, I don't know. It would be interesting to see how widely read these short stories were. That's the one thing that, like, you know, I genuinely don't really know.
Well, I think this one was just in like the Cornell magazine, so I doubt it was very
right. Yeah, it would be interesting to see like what these, how these were received, or what their actual like circulation was.
Yeah, and I think kind of a particular section that gets at what you're talking about, Luke, is the exchange between Rizzo and Levine, where Levine says, not exactly what I mean is something like a closed circuit, everybody on the same frequency, and after a while forget about the rest of the spectrum and start believing that this is the only frequency that counts or is real. Well, outside, all up or down the land, there are these wonderful colors and x-rays and ultraviolets going on. Don't you think Roach is on a closed circuit too? Rizzo said. McNeese is not the world, but Roach ain't the spectrum either. And then it just goes into like normal bickering. And it's such a strange excerpt because in any of his novels, that would have been just narrator voice or, you know, situated as the monologue of Levine, right? And it's interesting to see this attempt to be mixing these realms, mixing this purely instrumental, logic-driven, science, technology-based paradigm into the middle of these discussions of diffuse, like how people relate to one another. And to do it in a way that, for me at least, breaks immersion with the character of Levine. Because it's not like I was going through the story loving Levine or thinking, like really understanding him or anything. But I get what's going on with him, and I get his voice as a speaker in the scenes where he speaks. And then just suddenly he actually engages his mind in a way that he hasn't done up until that point.
Uh-huh.
And it also doesn't go anywhere.
It is certainly another aspect of it being an amateurish piece, mm-hmm. right? Like, as you've laid that out, that reminds me again of being a very young writer and thinking that it was better to have stuff like that delivered by characters, because then I was showing instead of telling.
Yeah.
But as you become a bit more of a mature writer and you do it more often, you understand sometimes it does break a character that you are putting out into the world that you're creating, as you've sort of articulated. And that's it. It's also okay to have a narrative voice provide things like that, because there are going to be certain concepts or ideas you're wanting to impart that don't function any other way.
Right.
So especially in the way that you've broke down how strange that section is, it really does find some resonance within me to the amateurish nature of when this was written in his sort of time or his career.
Well, and I don't want to just be negative, because I think when you look at Levine as a character, you know, there's a reason that he reuses kind of the broad strokes of the name as Pig, Bodine. There are reasons that, like, the elements of characters having, like, a strange, spiteful pride in their beer bellies or whatever is a recurring
right.
thing in his further writings. Like, there is something there, and he is getting at it. And Levine is not, like, some crass tell-not-show, I guess. He is a good enough author that he is well beyond that kind of criticism.
Yeah.
But it is this level of, okay, yeah, Levine is this underachiever who has recognized that he would rather just sit around and not do anything than try to actually engage himself. But we don't see why in any meaningful sense, or at least I don't. It's not necessarily that, you know, a protagonist must have a thrust, but it's more that he seems to experience an emotional change over the course of the story, and I'm honestly lost as to where that is.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's the thing, right, is that kind of mixing what I had mentioned earlier with this, all that stuff is in Pynchon's head, and he thinks that it's on the page, but when it comes to the actual perspective of the reader trying to navigate that same thing, it's not there. I would yeah. imagine that if you could, you know, speak to Pynchon in the year that he wrote that, he would tell you exactly where his sort of moment of development or evolution is. But that doesn't mean that to the average person reading the story that they're going to be able to pick up on that either. It's just an interesting facet of again, a writer developing their voice and their ability to write.
Yeah, I do think that everything about him, like growing restless and having this newfound sense of wanting more from life is more than a little bit undercooked. Let's go back to the cooking metaphor, where it just kind of seems to appear somewhat randomly. It's like, you know, he's faced with a lot of death, and then he starts getting a little, you know, restless and stuff. It's just not super, like, worked out or, like, on the page, really. It's not, like, earned, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
Well, in the spirit of trying to not just criticize a short story which was clearly not published out of a sense of achievement, I guess, what characters resonate for you? What moments in the plot actually seem to strike something for each of all of you guys?
I think that the nervousness depicted around sex is particularly well done.
Yeah.
Not just the fact that, as Pynchon himself comments in the introduction, that it's unclear what happens between the two of them, but the way that there is this inherent kind of fear or nervousness around the act itself for people of that age, and then mixed with kind of the jubilation of someone returning and being like, I got laid! And then obviously yeah. having a very different perspective from people who have probably experienced that many, many times. It's unclear if Levine is a virgin at the beginning of the story, but I wouldn't be surprised if he was, based upon yeah. the elements of his character and this, the writing kind of surrounding that. So I would say that certainly sticks out to me as being a particularly well done portion of it. I would also say that some of the writing around like the stench of death following him around after going on like body recovery
yeah.
certainly is effective in the way that it's done. And that idea of like him stepping into the shower and also like cleaning his uniform and all of that as a way of restoring his, I guess, humanity or his ability to connect with another person. And then that leads, of course, to the date that he goes on. Is also sort of an effective transition point there. So, you know, that I would say that chunk of the story from his body recovery to the recovery from that mission that he goes out on to his date and then his return is a particularly effective piece of the writing from my perspective.
I would totally agree. Like I said at the beginning, I think that the story gets more interesting as it progresses. I do like Levine as a character, as sort of underdeveloped as he is. He definitely displays a lot of the characteristics that Pynchon characters would come to embody, especially his kind of quirky, weird sense of humor, like always threatening to punch people in the mouth. I just found that kind of funny. Just such a weird thing to just constantly threaten people, like, well, why don't I just punch you in the mouth? But yeah, the end of it is especially the best part for me, and it's some of the best writing in this story. Particularly the scene after his we'll call it awkward encounter with his date, where he talks about the frogs that they're hearing outside, and the way that's written, I have it right here: around them, frogs intoned a savage chorus. Gradually, it seemed to them, spasmodic as they were, blinded yet curiously aware of this as little more than an entwining of little fingers, a touching of beer mugs, McCall's togetherness, working itself into a pedal bass for a virtuoso duet of small breathing, cries. He puffing occasionally at the cigar throughout the performance, the ball cap tilted carelessly, she evoking a casually protective feeling, a never totally violated passive, until at last, having subsided, assailed still by stupid frog cries, they lay not touching. That's really well written for everything else that's going on in the story, and I genuinely enjoyed that part. And
mm-hmm.
I think that if it would really kind of, I think, be interesting for him to revisit these and sort of rework them. That's something that I don't think I've ever seen done with any author, of going back and like reworking older short stories as a more mature and more intelligent author. So I would love to see what he could do if he were to go back and take these stories and apply what he now knows to them and what could come of them.
Yeah. You know, and I think it's interesting that he comments on that in the introduction. Mm-hmm. That's his first thought when he goes yeah. back to them. And there is a part of me that has wanted to do that before in the past. Like there, you know.
Oh, for sure.
The first novel, I use that word incredibly loosely, that I wrote when I was in eighth grade. I have at times gone back to the notebooks that's in and been like, yeah, maybe it'd be like a neat project to like rewrite this into something that's actually readable. It's an interesting idea, especially for someone who is a writer of his caliber and experienced such a jump in quality, mm-hmm. especially so soon after something like this was published.
Yeah.
I wonder about that, because as much as I agree, it would be interesting to see an author do that kind of exercise. When it comes to things like what you point out, Cody, about how Levine just repeatedly threatens to punch people in the head, when it's clear as the reader, at least to me, that the reason he's doing that is as like an insecure defense mechanism against people who are pushing him in to actually analyze his own motives in ways that he isn't comfortable doing because he feels like he should have it all figured out. And it's the kind of thing that I think if you're coming at it from any perspective except as what would he have been, a 21-year-old writing?
21, 22, yeah.
Yeah, like, if you're not coming at it from that perspective, I don't think you, not necessarily you can't capture that, but I think it takes a lot more talent than maybe even Pynchon has to be able to nail that kind of casual unthinkingness that young men especially have. Because it's not some like virtuosic thing of, oh my gosh, that's a perfect depiction of those kinds of defense mechanisms. The way it reads to me personally is literally as like 21-year-old, 22-year-old Pynchon thinking, this is a funny line.
Yeah.
It feels like you're supposed to laugh at that instead of furrow your brow and think, huh, what's up with this character? Why is he repressed in a way that someone who is raised around the beats would think is not repressed?
Those particular moments, him kind of having that reaction of threatening to punch people. I went to school with people like that. And so it definitely was like, okay, wow, I remember. Yeah, and especially around that age, like late high school, early college, where those kind of people, you know, that idea was very prevalent. So yeah, it definitely reads that way.
It comes across a little, like a little bit more of a joke in this specific context of between Corman, because, you know, if you actually did punch one of the people you're enlisted with in the face over essentially a shallow challenge to your authority or because you're just mad at them or something, you would get court-martialed and maybe go to prison because that's obviously not acceptable. Even in like normal society, it's not acceptable, but it's a completely different level of unacceptable among even young men in the army.
Luke, did you have any specific thing that stood out to you that you enjoyed?
As much as I wanted more from it, I did think the description of the dead bodies and finding the dead bodies and how disgusting the dead bodies were, I thought that was pretty well done. Like I said, I kind of wanted more of it and maybe a little bit more like actual scene and more of kind of interiority for Lardass and his reactions to it. What is there is pretty well written. You know, it doesn't pull any punches necessarily, which I do think that a lesser writer, even at his age, would have thought, you know, I had been worried about just like being disgusting, too disgusting or something, you know, where he does seem to deal with what the reality of that situation would be like, which I liked. Overall, I mean, it does have a kind of true to life aspect of it where, you know, unlike some of his novels and stuff where he plays with surrealism and absurdity a lot more, you know, this is a fairly grounded story, grounded in reality where, you know, if somebody were to tell you this story verbally, you would probably believe them, you know, as opposed to, you know, if somebody were to tell you the Mason and Dixon story verbally, which is obviously an aspect of that story, you know, about all the stuff about the flying duck and all this different stuff, mm-hmm. you're not going to actually believe what the person is saying. I mean, you're going to want to follow the story anyway, but you know, I did like that it's kind of grounded in realism.
Well, speak for yourself there, partner. I would believe that there's a mechanical though.
I want to believe at least.
that you know, that should be a poster that we sell of the duck and it says I want to believe instead of the UFO. The classic X-Files poster.
Oh my God. Somebody who's good at Photoshop, please make this happen.
That would be fucking hilarious.
Reading these stories really makes me wish that he had done more short story collections or put out more short stories as he grew as a writer.
I would be willing to bet if his archive is ever made public that there's probably a lot of short stories.
I really hope so.
I don't think that he's someone who wasn't doing that. I'd imagine that he just, in a lot of cases, thought that they weren't good enough to publish.
Very well could be.
I do think that he started, there are parts of Mason and Dixon that would work as short stories. Like the part about the Chinese astronomers especially comes to mind, where if you were to cut that out of that book, I'm not sure what would be lost from the main narrative. I mean, there'd be stuff lost, but I'm not sure what would be lost from the main narrative And I do think that the narrative of the Chinese astronomers will work on its own. You know, the Byron the Bulb section of Gravity's Rainbow could work on its own. I do think that there's
parts of Kids Today that do that too. Yeah.
Yeah. I could see some of those sections having been written as perhaps maybe not a standalone, but as a short story, and he just decided to work them into one of his novels or something. I can't be 100% sure that they were written specifically for those manuscripts, I guess. I would be pretty sure that they probably were, but you can't say for 100% that they were. So I do think that's kind of the route he went, was instead of doing standalone short stories, of trying to work these stories, smaller stories, into larger narratives.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I almost get the sense that in his general approach to writing, I just get the sense that the reason he uses long sentences in his later work, and the reason he writes these extremely long novels, you know, like, oh, Inherent Vice is the easiest Pynchon to read, and it's still, you know, 400 pages almost? It's still incredibly discursive and incredibly dense. I just get the sense that he, well, not necessarily to ascribe intentions or feelings to him, but I get the sense that his instinct as an author is towards expansion and interdependence in a way that doesn't suit the short story format. And so a lot of his books, from things as small as Inherent Vice to books like Gravity's Rainbow, I really get the sense that every single per se scene is or was on some level written independently or inspired independently at some point. And he is not that it's not necessarily an attempt to say, oh, this is Gravity's Rainbow, and this is what would be a good thing to happen next, or mm-hmm. to say this would achieve my thematic end, or this would be a good thing for the characters to experience. But just that these ideas appeared to him some way, somehow, and he decided to write it down, and at some point looked over his small drafts and was like, these work together thematically. These make sense. If I just change this character and change these details, it becomes...
Find the through lines that you can connect them with.
Yeah. And I forget, there's a specific name for that approach, isn't there? But
I think there is. I can't think of what it is, though.
Just going back to this story, I guess, there's a specific moment, and for some reason I cannot find it, where basically the third or fourth time I went through this story, I had just reread the introduction, and I really latched onto the point where he said that death is not handled seriously. And I get where that is very much a real aspect of V. When I was thinking specifically about this story, I was like, wait a second. These are all like 20-year-old enlisted army dudes. They're not going to have a mature idea about death. These are the real ways that they would react, and it's not just like, oh, it's a realist story, so you should have characters be realist, because that's not interesting. But when you really get to, there's a specific moment where an officer who is talking about how, you know, he was in Korea and people killing each other for maybe bad reasons was bad enough, but what is this? It really did click for me what he was saying about the immaturity of dealing with mortality in this story in particular. Because it isn't just that Levine is this weird contrarian, not pseudo-intellectual, but I guess quasi-intellectual. And it's not just that he's with a bunch of 20-year-olds in a camp. Even the people who are supposed to be expressing their war weariness are coming at it from the angle of, like, I would read it as like a high schooler's apprehension of what worldliness comes across as. Still looking for that specific quote. There, it's discussing the work of actually moving the dead. Levine and Douglas sat watching them while the sky got darker, losing more of the sun, which nobody could see. An old master sergeant came over to them and leaned against the side of the jeep, and they talked for a while. I was in Korea, he said after one of the bodies had disintegrated from clumsy handling. I can understand guys shooting at each other, killing each other, but this, he shook his head, Jesus Christ. It's not an issue of technique, it is truly an issue of intention, because what are we supposed to get out of that is not mm-hmm. just from the it's a hurricane, people have died, yeah, Maybe it's a factor of, you know, me being in the generation, or, you know, slightly younger than the generation of the characters in Bleeding Edge. I don't quite remember 9/11 and the media circus that followed that, but I do remember Hurricane Katrina. And so maybe for me, that's just a core part of my world, the senselessness of death and the way these things might be avoided.
Yeah, that's totally fair. You can definitely kind of feel what he's reaching for, even if he doesn't necessarily make it fully synthesized on the page, which is, you know, to your point, a lot of this stuff does come up in B. And I think that is kind of his, for obvious reasons, quintessential sort of military man narrative, given how heavily that has to do with the main character and a lot of the early portions of the book, especially. Well, that brings us to the end of the first episode covering the early stories of Thomas Pynchon in the Slow Learner Collection. We will be back to our regularly scheduled programming, so to speak, soon enough with a return to the Against the Day narrative. What week is that next episode coming out, Cody?
That's a good question. Let me figure it out real quick. So the 28th is when we'll be back for Against the Day.
All right. So until then, we will see you all next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Screw it. Leave it in.
Yep.